Move to the next case of the morning. Susan Eichstadt versus Michael Estru.
Right.
And you are Mr. Cohen?
Erwin Cohen, and I represent Suzanne Eichstadt. May it please the panel. We're here, we're asking essentially that the decision of the administrative law judge and of the district court be reversed. And it's, I believe, if you read closely, essentially there's two main cases that seem to bear on that, one of which is the Sheck case and the other is the Briscoe case. And what we have here essentially, and a lot of argument as you read the briefs, is relates to Social Security Regulation 8320, which is the termination of the onset of disability. Now, one of the things that's very interesting about this case is is Ms. Eichstadt filed sometime in, I think it was 03 or 04, she files for disability, and disability is alleged. It goes back as far as December 31st of 1987. This poses numerous problems. In the case, one of which is the fact that there's very little records available. But at any rate, as you go into it, and some of the cases that have to be, that bear essentially on this point, the main one that we relied on originally was Sheck. And what Sheck says essentially is in defining 8320, which determines the onset date, addresses the situation which an administrative law judge makes a finding that an individual is disabled as of an application date. And the question arises whether the disability arose at an earlier time. Well, in the Sheck case, apparently what happened was the ALJ, administrative law judge, did not find that Sheck was disabled, and therefore there was no need to set an onset date as Social Security Reg 8320 says. Now, that's where there's a little difference between us, our case, and the Sheck case. And what happened, I believe, with the ALJ in this one is they assumed, and there was no finding one way or another in our case. However, in Sheck, well, where it may not have been very distinct, Sheck essentially essentially found that they were not disabled on the date that they filed their that he filed his application, and therefore didn't make any difference as to what happened on the onset date. And if you analyze that, that's pretty good reasoning.
But Mr. Cohen, I mean, following up with that, looking at 8320, and I just don't see how, at least under the facts of this case, it makes any difference. Because if the ALJ had found that Ms. Eichstadt was not disabled on the date of application in December 2003, then, as you say, the case would be over. If she found, and I think, you know, you can infer, maybe she assumes for the sake of argument, Ms. Eichstadt was disabled as of December 12, 2003, that just raises the question, well, was she disabled on date last insured, which is all the way back December 31, 1987. She's going to have to focus on the very evidence she focused on at that point, which is there any evidence in this record that would allow a rational inference that she was disabled that early? And all we have are these essentially dental records of the jaw problem, and there just isn't evidence there. And it looked to me like the ALJ looked carefully at the evidence and finds that she just can't go back that far.
Well, I think your analysis of the holding of Sheck and that, of course, brings into play also the holding in Briscoe is correct. The first step is it's a two-step process. Prong number one is you have to find that they're disabled on the date that they filed.
Yeah, let's just assume there was such a finding. It really, in this case, the key point is whether the onset date is before or after December 31st, 1987. And if you can't show an onset date that's before that date, then she's not entitled under this statutory scheme to benefits. We're not really talking about whether she's disabled today or not. She may well be, but there's this onset date rule.
Well, I think it's double barrel, Judge. And if you read the Sheck case, step number one, you have to find she's disabled on the date she filed her application. Otherwise, if she's not disabled on that
date. But I'm just saying, how can she be hurt by the lack of that finding if the judge goes on, if the ALJ goes on to step two, which you agree she would not have gone on to if she hadn't found disability on the date of application? She just would have said, you know, here's somebody, and I don't even think they're disabled now, end of discussion. In fact, by the mere fact of going on to look at onset date, the ALJ is either making an express finding or at least saying, for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume disability.
Well, the problem that we have on this one is, if you check the record and our brief, the first thing that the ALJ says is all the evidence, all the records that you produced after December 31st, 1987 is irrelevant.
To the question of onset date, because it's so much later than that. I mean, I don't know why she waited this long. People have all kinds of reasons, but it does make it, as you began yourself by acknowledging, it makes it a much tougher issue from an evidentiary standpoint.
Oh, there's no question about
medical
it.
Records get lost. You know, I don't know if you ever tried to introduce any lay testimony about her condition during the 1980s. I didn't see anything like that.
There was none, Judge. And the reason that we didn't try to produce any of that, when she knocks out the medical records by saying we're not going to consider anything as relevant after December 31st, 1987.
Or it could have been a medical record. Suppose there had been something in 1990 where a doctor had said, you know, I'm satisfied given the progression of this disease that it's been in place for at least 4 years. You know, something like that. But there's nothing like that in this record.
Oh, sure there is, Judge. If you go, but you have to go considerably past 1990.
Well, you have to go so far that you have one person, the rheumatologist, right?
Actually, more than that, and that's one of the things that where we had a problem with it, was there's all kinds of histories by Dr. Weiss.
But they're all the same. That's just her telling her tale over and over again. Doctors write down the history, and that's why it's called a history. It's what the patient is telling the doctor.
Well, sure.
I'm not sure that adds weight to the account.
Well, first of all, on histories, that's always, histories just by its very nature, what the patient tells them.
Right. So the patient could tell one doctor or 15 doctors. It's still the patient's account of what the experience has been.
And then Dr. Verges goes on. She filled out the questionnaire, and she relates it back. And, of course, one of the reasons the ALJ discounted it is just, well, she first saw her in 1999. That's 12 years later. But
and given that we're not the finder of fact and it's a deferential standard of review, how can we say that was an irrational act on the ALJ's part?
Well, I think the irrational act on the ALJ's part was just saying right off the bat and not listening or looking at any of the evidence that was presented, medical evidence, after December 31st that made the burden of proof impossible in this case. If we present any lay testimony after that statement, we have nothing medically to back any of it up. And so we're in an impossible situation. We're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. And by making that statement, that there's not, that she will not consider any of the evidence, she made it impossible for us to prove the first prong, that she was disabled on the date she filed, and then carry everything back, introduce other evidence so that she wouldn't say, as she did say, that the plaintiff was, that the claimant was not credible. And I think the big problem here and everything, all the other problems thereafter, was from the fact that she just refused to accept any evidence of any kind after December 31st, 1987. We were in an impossible position. We couldn't possibly have proven our case. And that's why we asked this court, let's get everything in. If it doesn't fall into place, fine, we lose. But at least we should have that option. We should
have
that.
What would be in? What would be in that would reflect back to 1987? Just as an example, something that was not allowed to come in, other than a doctor's, I don't call it speculative, but presumption or something that 15 years earlier she had this and that. She did have the TMJ.
Well, there was,
and went through that, and we have the records of that, and that was at least theoretically resolved.
No, there was
the
also
where that was, well, I mean, it had problems and other things, but it's not the permanent disability that we're looking at now, or you're looking at.
There was also some indication from the records that she had a birth defect. With the
back to her birth, then, doesn't it?
The what?
And the ALJ pointed out with respect to that that she'd actually worked for a number of years despite whatever problems that might have caused. So the ALJ makes a comment saying, well, that can't be something that makes her disabled for purposes of the statute.
No, but when you package that together with the jaw, and I think there was, if you read some of the medical regarding the jaw, that was rather considerable surgery, considerable problems. And when you package it all together, and one of the things that we say is there should have been a doctor present at that time so that they can determine how serious that jaw was and whether or not it was disabling. And what the ALJ did essentially was she foreclosed us completely from presenting any case. Whether or not she considered that, but we have to assume when she says, I won't consider, it's all irrelevant, then you have to assume that she did not. And we just, it was impossible to present a case.
Okay, well, you're going to run out of time here, so when we save any for rebuttal, you better.
Okay, then let me close for the moment.
Okay. Ms. Gum?
Good morning. My name is Janet Gum. I represent the commissioner in this matter. I have something prepared, but what I really want to address is this concept that the ALJ refused to look at any evidence after December 31st, 1987. In her decision, the ALJ said, I consider a lot of that evidence so far removed that it's essentially not relevant, which makes sense because you look at information after the date last insured, and the closer it is to the date last insured, the more relevant it is. You get into 1995, 2001, 2003, and further, it's really so remote as to not be relevant at all. But the ALJ did not preclude all that evidence. The ALJ, in her decision, talked about several pieces of evidence that was after her date last insured. She talked about the claimant's, the claimant had made a schedule of all the doctors that she had seen. The ALJ refers to that. She had gone to a doctor in 1999. The ALJ refers to that. She went to the doctor in 2001. The ALJ referred to that. Dr. Vargas made an opinion that issued an opinion that she was disabled, and the ALJ looked at that. Discounted that particular decision, and not just because it was so far removed from the date last insured, but also because it wasn't consistent with the record as it stood. The ALJ talked about the fact that during that time period, she was going swimming regularly. One of the doctors commented that she comes in and complains of pain, and yet she's able to move around freely. So the ALJ had very good reasons for discounting that. But the point is, the ALJ did not preclude any evidence coming in that was later. The ALJ looked at all that evidence, said, as I think we might all agree, that the farther removed you get from the date last insured, the less relevant it is.
So would the ALJ have permitted evidence to be introduced from time periods before the date last insured that was of a lay nature, you know, her colleagues at work or her family saying she can barely walk across the room or anything?
I don't see why not. No one suggested that. No one brought that to the hearing. No one suggested
but it
that.
As far as you know, that's not something they preclude.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I think that's part of the regulations. They look around and they see what other kind of evidence there is. Because in a perfect world, we would have contemporaneous medical records of the from the alleged onset date to the date last insured, and we don't have a perfect world, and so we take what we can. The ALJ did everything. The agency did everything they could to help her get these records. She gave them a list of doctors, and they wrote every single one of them. And those doctors all wrote back and said, I don't know who you're talking about. She's not on our records. We don't know who this person is. The ALJ asked the claimant if she would help him obtain some of these records, thinking that perhaps she could be more persuasive. She didn't. She did, however, constantly write into the ALJ and say, here's my list of doctors that I went to or whatever, but there was no testimony suggested. And it's her burden. I think that's an important thing to remember here. This was a step four case. This was her burden every step of the way. She was supposed to be bringing in this evidence. She didn't do that. She didn't meet her burden, and that's why I think the court should affirm the commissioner.
You know, as I understand her argument, and particularly the way 8320 fits into it, it's I guess it's an idea that if there had been a determination, a formal determination on the record, that she was disabled as of December 12, 2003, the date of the mm-hmm. application, at that point, there really actually would have been some burden on the ALJ to bring in a medical expert if all the rest of these avenues turned out to be unproductive. And that, I guess, is the one piece of this puzzle that we don't have. We have the exploration of the doctors who were out there. We have the medical evidence that she presented. What we don't have is some other person somehow coming in as a medical expert.
Well, I don't think SSR 8320 or Scheck or any of the other case law in this circuit requires that the ALJ go out and get a medical expert under any circuit, or doesn't require him to go out and get a medical expert. You need a medical expert when you need a medical expert, and that's a decision of the ALJ. If the ALJ can't make heads or tails of the case, perhaps a medical expert is necessary. If there's some medical condition that's so complicated that it's difficult to read the record and figure out what to do, that's when you use a medical expert. In this case, the ALJ looked at the record. The ALJ had some pieces of evidence, had the contemporaneous TMJ problem, had a little bit of information about her treatment afterwards, her long gaps. She had a...
Before you get too much further, though, in 8320, I'm looking at the part of it that is in boldface. It says policy statement, then onset and disabilities of traumatic origin. Maybe that's not this anyway, but how long the disease may be determined to have existed at a disabling level severity depends on an informed judgment of the facts. Judgment has to have a legitimate medical basis. And then it says, at the hearing, the administrative law judge should call on the services of a medical advisor when onset must be inferred. And I guess that's what she's relying on, that of course onset has to be inferred here.
Sure, so if you find disability. At the very top of SSR 20, it starts off with their introduction. In addition to determining that an individual is disabled, you have to infer an onset date. Well, that's only common sense. If a person's disabled, when did that happen? At what point do they become disabled? And there's a procedure to go through to say what you would look at for that.
But is there ever a finding of disability in this?
No, there isn't.
Decision?
No, there isn't. The ALJ did not find that the person was disabled at any point, and I think that's what makes it makes Scheck directly on point.
And that's where you go to step four. You wouldn't even reach step four, though, if there wasn't some kind of disability.
Well,
logically.
Well, step four, no, you don't find disability. What you find is a severe impairment, and you move on from step one to two and three and four. You don't have to find disability at any of those steps. In fact, if at any point you find disability, you just stop looking. You say, oh, the person meets a listing. And which, by the way, I would encourage the court, we don't have time to talk about today, but I encourage the court to notice that not only the commissioner believes that the claimant has waived her listing argument, but actually doesn't even make an argument that she meets or equals the listing. She just wants us to get a medical expert to tell us what the ALJ had already decided. But in any case, nothing requires that we make a finding of disability at any point. She came in very, very late. We're looking at evidence that's two decades after her date last insured. It's a reasonable assumption that if she can't be disabled in the earlier time period, there's no reason to even look to see if she's disabled later. But the doctor who issued a statement of disability, the ALJ reasonably discounted because the evidence just wasn't there. So had the ALJ been forced to make a ruling, the commissioner would assert that the ALJ would have made a finding of non-disability. The point is the ALJ didn't need to go there, and the ALJ didn't go there, and the record is clear enough that the ALJ did not need a medical expert to make this determination.
And as far as the eligibility, it goes back to December 31st, 1987. Is that when there's not enough quarters accumulated or something? Where you
Right. It's a complicated little formula that, thank goodness, I don't have to do.
But presumably, she just didn't have any kind of employment that made her eligible after that.
Right. What happens in a Title II case, which is what this is, it's based on your employment record. The agency calculates that, and that's not anything that's in dispute today, but the agency calculates that based on the number of quarters you've worked. They calculate it back and come forward. They do some mathematical system. And you have to establish disability on or before that date in order to be entitled to Title II benefits, and she didn't do that. If there are no other questions, I thank you for the time and would respectfully ask that you affirm the commissioner's decision.
You're about out of time, but we'll give you a minute or so.
There was no finding of disability because there was no records that could possibly have a finding of disability. Right off the bat, the ALJ says, said I will not consider records past December 31st, 1987. Well, that takes the wind out of our sail pretty much, but also it makes it a physical impossibility to find one of the things that she had to find. Either she was or was not disabled on the date she filed her application, and that could not have been done. Now, some argument was made of the fact that in her decision, the ALJ did make reference of these records. At the time of the hearing, we had no indication she was going to do that, and I'm not sure she did because she point blank told us, I will not consider anything. We had no reason to believe that she would. The regarding the requirement of a medical expert, I believe that 8320 is rather adamant about that. When it must be inferred or disability, you need a medical expert. And one of the interesting cases is Briscoe, which there was a medical expert that came in onset date or the date last insured was 91. He came in and said, well, the medical record shows she's disabled in 94. What about 91, doctor? He hasn't got, said, I haven't got the foggiest idea. But that's where you need a medical expert in a situation like that, and that's what Briscoe said. And in this case, where you have to infer it, you have to have a medical expert.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement.